Blog Talk Radio.
I'll have a blue Christmas without you. I'll feel so blue. Just thinking about you. It'll be decorations of red on a green Christmas tree. It won't be the same, dear, if you're not here with me. And when those blue snowflakes start falling, it'll be that's when those blue in memories start calling. You'll be doing all right with your Christmas but I'll have a blue Christmas. Baby, I'll miss you. You'll be doing all right with your Christmas up with your wife. But I'll have a blue Christmas.
I don't care who you are. That's funny. I've listened to that about 5 times today, and it has broke me up every single time. From now on, I play the guitar, by the way, kind of like Roger Moore, and that was really badly. But I play the guitar as well. And from now on, whenever I sing Blue Christmas, by damn, that's exactly how I'm going to sing it. Hey, everybody. James Bostic here, Conservative's Perspective on the Patriot Nation Radio Network. Good to be here with you on blogtalkradio.com. We do it live 2 times a week. We do it Tuesdays and Thursdays, both 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. 2-hour format on Tuesdays, 1-hour format on Thursdays, when we couple up with our pal El Guapo, the handsome one, Mark Hoffman. I'm not exactly sure Mark was talking because he has a lot of really he's pretty busy. He's got a lot of things on his plate coming up with the holiday season, and they are good, happy family things, positive things. So he may be on hiatus till after, to coming back in January. And if that's the case, we'll probably do an expanded version on Thursdays. Well, guys, and we have a recorded version of the show as well that goes out on the Mojo 5.0 radio network, mojo50.com. If you're not listening, you should be, because it is the very best in libertarian and conservative talk radio. Got a good one for you tonight, and anytime our next guest is with us, it's a guaranteed good one. He is a former federal agent with the Bureau of Immigration. He has had almost 30 years of experience as an immigration officer. He worked in the fields of counter-espionage, counterterrorism, drug enforcement, organized crime, and illegal immigration as they would pertain to United States federal laws concerning that. It is our friend, Mr. Michael Cutler, back with us. And early on, because Mike and I are coming up on sort of an anniversary, I met him a couple years ago this coming January at a thing called Rock the Red through some mutual friends of ours, Don Ewan and Donna Fiducia. And we hit it off immediately. I knew in 10 minutes with talking to the guy, I had to have him come on the radio program if I could get him to. He graciously consented to, and boy, we've been off to the races ever since. Tonight, another in an ongoing and very, very enjoyable line of Michael Cutler talks about whatever the hell he wants to. And here he is, our friend, Mr. Michael Cutler. Mike, welcome back to ACP. I am really glad to have you here.
Thank you, James. I'm happy to join you. It's always a privilege and a pleasure. And, we've become friends since then. And it's about having a conversation. I mean, where we've gone these days, where the First Amendment has gone, you know, for the longest time, conservatives have been concerned about the Second Amendment. And I've always warned them, watch out for the First Amendment as well. And I sent you four quotes just before we went on the air. And
yes,
talking about the First Amendment, let's start out with this one quote. If the freedom of speech is taken away, then dumb and silent, we may be led like sheep to the slaughter. George Washington said that. Think about that. We have got to learn to sit down as fellow Americans and have conversations. And even if we disagree, so what? I don't have to agree with anybody all the time or even half the time. And you know what? I find conversations are most interesting when there is a diversity of opinion. This my way or the highway is nuts. And we frequently hear people saying, well, I'm not going to listen to that news program because they're way to the left, or that one is way to the – well, let's listen to what other people think. They may be wrong. They might be right. It may force us to reassess how we see issues. And you know what's funny? Because since 9/11, and you know, I've been a man on a mission since 9/11, James, I've traveled all over the country. I've been invited to stay at people's homes. They put me up in amazing hotels. It has been the journey of a lifetime. I've had opportunities to have dinner with people like Robert Duvall, the film actor. In fact, I had dinner with him not once, but twice. Great guy. He insisted that I call him Bobby. I've met people everywhere from every walk of life. And what's really amazing is that when you sit down and have conversations, what strikes me the most is how similar we are even when we think we're not similar. And so I remember being in Arizona, and we were driving along the U.S.-Mexican border, and the guy that was driving me was a retired dentist from New Jersey, living in Arizona right near the border. And he had bought himself a big-ass Caddy Escalade. The damn thing reminded me of a covered wagon, because when I looked in the back seat, he had a 12-gauge shotgun, boxes of ammunition, blankets, jumper cables, candy bars, jugs of water. I said, are you prepared for something? And he said, look, out here, you're on your own. And this was about 18 years ago, perhaps, not long after 9/11. He said, take your cell phone and see how many bars you can get on that phone. Can you make any phone calls? And he was right. For nearly a half hour, as we drove along, my cell phone was as worthless as if it had dead batteries. And so I asked him about the ruts in the road, because they were perpendicular to the road that ran parallel to the Mexican border. He said, those ruts are carved by the smugglers who bring people and narcotics into the United States. And he said they keep coming on that same path, and after a while they've carved grooves into the road, because when they get to the other side of the road, generally there are trucks or vehicles waiting for them. And sometimes, he warned me, they will carjack people. Not generally during the day, but it has happened. And he asked me if I was able to handle a 12-gauge shotgun. I said, absolutely. He says, well, I have a 45 on my hip. He said, if anything happens, you go for the shotgun, and I've got my 45. And he was serious. Now, I had been an agent for 26 years, and for 4 years prior to that, I was an immigration inspector. So I was with the old INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, for a total of about 30 years. And for 26 years, I carried a firearm. In fact, now the inspectors are also armed, something that I had always said should have been the case. It wasn't when I was an inspector at Kennedy Airport. That has changed, fortunately. But he said to me, I bet you don't have a problem with gun control. I said, well, up until recently, I had a badge. I could take my son, as I did when he was four, to Disney World, and I flew with a gun on my hip. I had my old .357. That's before we went to semi-automatic weapons. This was back in the late 80s, early 90s. So I had my big old .357 on my hip. The crew knew I had it. Everything was okay. It was, you know, sanctioned by law, because I was a federal agent. My authority extended across the country. I was strolling through Disney World with my gun on my hip. And now here I am retired, so I have a carry permit. So, yeah, I said, you know, maybe my perspectives have changed a bit, but I still don't have a big issue with gun control. I said, I tend to lean in that direction. And he looked at me, And he said, do you realize that out here, if we don't have firearms, we're dead? He said, first of all, you can't call for help. Second of all, if you do get the call for help, you're lucky if they show up in an hour. They'll come just in time to put up some crime scene tape. And I thought about that. Now, I mean, this is important. And by the way, there's been a couple of good little slogans that go with the Second Amendment. One says, good gun control means a good two-handed grip. The other one.
Exactly.
And the other one said, when I'm trying to remember the exact phrase, how it goes, when seconds count, police are minutes away.
Yes, exactly. That's one of my favorites right there, and that's true. It's true.
Okay, but he made me think, which is what a good conversation is supposed to do, ladies and gentlemen. We're supposed to have a conversation. It's entertaining. It's fun. It's a way of renewing friendships, but it's a way of making us think. And over dinner, we talked about the Holocaust. And, you know, I'm Jewish. I was named for my mother's mother, who was killed in Poland by the Nazi thugs because of our religion. And as we were having dinner with a bunch of folks from Arizona, I don't remember if it was the dentist or someone else, started talking about the Holocaust, and we got into a discussion about it. And he said, do you realize that the first thing that Hitler did was to disarm the people? And I thought about that. And I said, wow. And then I came home from my trip. My mother-in-law from my first wife was still alive. My first wife tragically died in her early 30s of breast cancer, a real horror show. Life is difficult for everybody. And that's why when I hear this nonsense about white privilege and critical race theory, we need critical empathy theory. We need critical thinking. I don't care what your skin color is. We all go through hell in this life. My dad used to say that if you could take all of your problems and hang them up on a clothesline for all to see, and you could stroll down the block and look at your neighbor's problems, you'd probably come back for your own problems. Because nobody gets through life unscathed. We should be looking to help each other out, irrespective of what I call superficial factors, race, religion, ethnicity. That's trivial. We are people. And I remember I had cancer 20 years ago, James. I think we talked about it. I had prostate cancer. And I had lost both of my parents to cancer within a year of each other when I was in college. And then not long after I got married, and my first wife dies of breast cancer. Our son was all of 22 months old. Life is a tough battle for everybody. But I remember when I was diagnosed, I thought, oh, my gosh, I have four children. My youngest has autism. How in the world is my wife going to cope? What do I do? I was really going nuts. And I went to have a scan done to see if the cancer had spread, because if it had spread, they wouldn't bother with surgery. Thank God it did not spread. It was contained, and I had the surgery, and I'm still here because I had a couple of great doctors, including Dr. Romas, who did the surgery, chief of urology at a major hospital at the time, and one of the people who devised the PSA test, by the way. But at the time, I didn't know what was going to happen. I went for the scan, and I'm lying on this machine at this major hospital in New York City. And the thing is, you know, going back and forth over me, scanning a radioactive tracer that had been injected into me hours earlier. And I'm thinking, how many people probably lay on this very same table and didn't make it? It's very sobering, very sobering. And I got off the table kind of vibrating. And there was a gentleman, I'm in my, you know, in my exam robe, and there's another guy similar who happens to be black, doesn't much matter. And that's the whole point. He looked at me, he said, how are you doing? I said, I have no idea. I said, how are you doing? He says, I don't know either. I said, you have cancer? He said, yeah. I said, me too. And you know what? I didn't know this guy from a hole in the wall. I don't even know what his name was. You know, we hugged each other, and I cried on his shoulder, and he cried on my shoulder. You know why? Because we're both human beings. This garbage about critical race, toxic. It is destroying America. It's destroying society. It's doing irreparable damage to lives across the country. I didn't care if he was purple and had green polka dots, and I don't think he cared that I was white. All we were hoping is that we would each beat this damn killer known as cancer. And the nurse came out with a clipboard, a radiologist, rather, a Chinese-American lady, and she said to me, have you ever had surgery on your knee? I said, well, I've had arthroscopy, and my knee is messed up. Why? She said, well, it lit up like the 4th of July, like Times Square. She said, but you've had problems with the leg. I said, yes. So she hugged me, and she said, Mr. Cutler, you're good to go. We were just worried because it looked like maybe something spread to your knee. But if you've had surgery, that explains it. We're going to clear you for surgery. And again, this black gentleman, this fellow human being, hugged me. He said, I am so happy for you. He said, thank God. And I wished him well, and I got dressed and went my way. He went his way. I hope to God he's alive and celebrating Christmas in a couple of weeks with his family. But the point is, we're all humans, and we've all got to look out for each other. And I've even taken on a new attitude. You know, we all get upset by the yo-yos who cut us off on the highway. And one day I was watching some guy driving like an absolute lunatic, and I had a horrible thought. I said, what if this guy got one of those phone calls no one ever wants to get? What if he's racing to a hospital or God knows where because he has a family emergency? And you know what? That's the attitude I now take every time I see somebody driving like a jackass. He might be a jackass. Odds are pretty good. But he may be somebody who's having a crisis. We need to learn to have compassion for one another. What do you think of that, James?
Well, it sounds like a novel concept when you look at the way most people live their lives today, insulated, very isolated, as well as insulated.
And self-centered and egocentric,
yes.
Right? They're sending out photographs of dinner to the world. Now, if I'm on a business trip, I might send my wife or my kids a photograph because I'm at a nice restaurant having a great meal and say, well, I wish you were sharing this with me. But do I really think 5,000 people want to see what Mike Cutler had for dinner last night? I mean, could you be more self-absorbed than that? Am I missing something?
No, you're not missing a thing, and it happens. You know, it happens all the time. And social platforms, and I think to a certain extent, anybody that engages in them, and that includes myself, to varying degrees, when they engage in them, it kind of lends itself to this
narcissism.
cultivation of narcissism. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think anybody can be sucked into it and be seduced by it. And you think, oh gosh, I'm getting all these likes. What can I say next to get more likes? And look at all these people. And I think you're right. I think you're absolutely
look
right.
Look at all the friends I have. All the friends I have.
These people love me. Yeah, exactly.
You know, my father said to me very wisely, he said, Mike, in going through life, if you have as many friends as fingers on both hands, actually the fingers on one hand, you will have done well. And my parents told me that a friend is somebody that you can call up at 3:30 in the morning with an emergency, and they come running asking only two questions, where are you and what do you need? And he said, if you have a friend like that, you need to reciprocate because one-sided relationships aren't relationships. I don't even have a Facebook account. I mean, I do, but I never use it. I don't even know how to use the darn thing. I don't care about this garbage. I text when I need to. I do email. That's the limit of my social website stuff. But the idea that these are all my friends, try to call them up at 3:30 in the morning when you have a flat tire, see who shows up. What do you think of that?
Exactly. Yeah, we'll find out who our real friends are immediately. Hello?
Immediately.
Hello?
You'll whittle it down quickly. Yes. It's like dial a prayer for atheists. You call, but nobody answers. How's that? I want to get to these other three quotes. With your permission, I want to get into some articles I've written because I want everyone to understand what's happening. And then I want to spend the rest of this evening perhaps discussing how we can reach out to our neighbors, especially the ones who may disagree with us, because they're not our adversaries. They're our allies if we can win them over. I really want to focus, because this is the holiday of the season of holidays, which is wonderful. We just finished with Hanukkah and Thanksgiving, and I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving. We had a great
Absolutely.
Thanksgiving. My oldest son lives out of town. He came in with his wife and our two grandchildren, and the other kids live nearby, so we were all together. And when I could be with my kids and my grandchildren and my wife and our puppy, I'm a happy guy. You know, everyone's here and all's right with the world. Stay focused. But here's the four quotes. We already did George Washington about the First Amendment. So Kennedy has two good quotes. First quote, let us not seek the Republican answer or the Democratic answer, but the right answer. Let us not seek to fix the blame for the past. Let us accept our own responsibility for the future. And when I read that, I thought specifically of critical race theory and the 1619 Project. There are idiots and malevolent individuals who want America to focus on what happened back on 1619 when the first slave ship arrived in the United States. This is madness, because if you take it out of context, you're missing the bigger issue. Slavery at the time was global. It was as accepted as horses and buggies. It was as accepted as mowing lawns or plowing the fields, not mowing lawns, but plowing fields. It was a horrendous, horrific practice. I'm not going to tell you I could justify it. I can't. But slavery has existed since the Bible. Being Jewish, I could tell you the Jewish people were enslaved in the Bible. It's a horrible, horrific practice. It's an atrocity. It's an abomination. But I didn't do it, and you didn't do it, and nobody alive in America today did it. And to say that America is never going to be acceptable because it began with slavery is insane, because every country practiced it just about. So that means we ignore civilization altogether, and we ignore that there are countries, and we ignore all the achievements and everything else that we've accomplished. This is madness. It's nihilism. And the fact that anyone could buy into this level of madness makes me wonder how many people need to be put in a padded room so they can't hurt themselves. By the way, if we're going to talk about slavery, why don't we talk about the progress that humanity made to end it? And America led the charge. So why don't we focus on that? And how do you hold people responsible for the crimes not committed by their parents, or their grandparents, but we're going to go back 10 generations. Or we're going to accuse people of wrongdoing when their ancestors weren't even in the United States and they're first-generation Americans. I'm first-generation American on my mom's side and second-generation American on my dad's side. What did my family have to do with slavery? Nothing. Okay? So, again, this is this narrative. What worries me about it, I'm Jewish, and this is how the Holocaust started. And when I mentioned to you that dentist who talked about firearms and Hitler and so forth, my first wife's parents were in the Holocaust. Her father was on the run, hiding in the forests in Poland. His brother was grabbed by the Nazis and machine gunned to death because he violated curfew. Her mother, my mother-in-law, was in a concentration camp. And I said to her, why in the world didn't the people fight back? She said, well, there was the Warsaw Uprising. And my grandmother was in Poland, by the way, similar background. She said, there was the Warsaw Uprising, but understand how handicapped we were. I said, how were you handicapped? She said, they took away all the guns. Nobody had guns, only the military and the police had guns. We were unarmed. Now, the irony is she was staunchly anti-gun. When I started dating my first wife, I'd show up with a gun on my hip. Well, why did I have a gun? Well, I was a federal agent. So the first time I came to their house, the first thing I did was take out my badge and my credentials, and I say, I want you to know I have a firearm, and this is why I have a firearm. It's part of my requirement as an agent to be armed at all times. If there's an emergency, I need to respond. I have to have a gun with me. And so I used to go to their house, and if I had dinner, I would take my gun off, put it on, you know, in a closet somewhere, and I wouldn't see the darn thing till I was ready to go home. But they were always uncomfortable around firearms, and, oh, it's a terrible thing. And one night we almost got mugged. And so she told her mother, you know, at the time she was my fiancée, she told her mother, You know, if it wasn't for the fact that Mike had a gun, God knows what would have happened, because this guy ultimately mugged somebody and left him stripped naked in the middle of the street in the dead of winter. So she started to get a little bit better about it. And finally, I said to her, you know, we had a discussion a long time ago about how the Nazis were all armed and the people that they imprisoned and dragged off to their death, dragged off to the concentration camps, had no firearms. How in the world could you not learn the lesson that history should have taught you in particular, because you lived through it? And, you know, from that day forward, she would always say to me, you're walking your dog, make sure you take your gun with you, you know? So, but understand the value of conversation, the value of sharing ideas without condescension, without nastiness, without saying, what are you, stupid? No one's stupid. And you know, what really upsets me, and this is one of my pet peeves, I do a lot of writing for Front Page magazine. I've been writing for the David Horowitz Freedom Center. They sponsor Front Page. I've been writing for them since 2014. Very proud of my association with David and his group and that publication.
Yeah.
But sometimes people will leave comments after my articles, and some of the comments are pretty upsetting. And what upsets me is when people will use derogatory language to describe the Democrats. I'm not talking about the politicians. The politicians are fair game, which brings me to Plato's great quote, since we're looking at these quotes. One of the penalties for refusing to participate in politics is that you end up being governed by your inferiors. Plato said that. You could almost say it today, couldn't you? Interesting thought.
Oh, we definitely could say it today. Absolutely, we can say it today.
Right? One of the penalties for refusing to participate in politics is that you end up being governed by your inferiors. Boy, does that ever seem appropriate. So the point of the matter is, though, that if you understand how people think and why they think a certain way, accept the fact that the people that we probably want for friends are compassionate, moral, decent people, right? You don't want to be friends with someone who's a jackass and only thinks of himself and could care less about anybody else. You want to be friends with people who are charitable, with people who are willing to share, with people who show warmth and emotion, right? You don't want to be friends with a cold-hearted SOB. So how many times have you heard people talk about Democrats, and I'm not talking about the politicians now, Americans who are registered as Democrats. And by the way, full disclosure, I'm one of them. I know about five people just fell over, but no, I'm a registered Democrat. Haven't voted for a Democrat in ages, but the Republicans don't offer us much either, to be perfectly honest about it. Okay, I call them the Republicrats for the most part. But the point of the matter is, I always hear the same nonsense. Oh, the Democrats and their emotions, their feelings. And I remember some woman said that to me, and I said, are you married? She said, yes. I said, do you love your husband? She said, of course I do. I said, that sounds like a feely kind of a thing. You have love for your husband? You have love for your children also? Because she had just complained to me about how the Democrats are ruled by their emotions. I said, so when your husband proposed, I presume he proposed. She said, yes, he did. I said, did you immediately run to your computer and prepare a spreadsheet to decide whether or not to accept? How's that?
Got to look at that bottom line.
Right?
It's nothing personal. It's just business. Like in The Godfather.
Is Cutler twisted?
Oh, and I give you 2 hours to prove it.
And I'm happy to do it. But seriously, what do you mean that they're all about their emotions and their feelings? I said, so you didn't have any emotions when your husband proposed to you? And when your child was born, you didn't have any emotions? I said, look, we're supposed to, as intelligent adults, make decisions based on both our emotions and the facts. You weigh all the issues. And who would want a friend that has no emotions? I mean, cold-hearted isn't exactly a compliment. And when I think of Jeffrey Bezos, I can't think of a more cold-hearted SOB, right? He launched that rocket, the Blue Origins, with Alan Shepard's daughter on board. And by the way, I got a letter from Alan Shepard back when I was in junior high school, and he did that suborbital flight back on May 5th, 1961. And all of my friends were as envious as you could possibly imagine. They made a big announcement in the auditorium during an assembly, and I held up the letter, and I got a round of applause, and everybody went wild. Because to me, the American heroes don't play football or baseball. My favorite oxymoron is heroic play. I'm still trying to figure out how the hell you can be a hero when you're playing. My heroes growing up were astronauts and test pilots. I've had the privilege of meeting a bunch of astronauts. I met Jim Lovell, Dave Scott, Jim McDivitt. They all flew to the moon. Jim Lovell twice, Apollo 13. I met Gene Kranz. He was the flight director for Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, and the beginnings of the space shuttle program. And with another controller was credited with bringing the Apollo 13 crew home alive after the explosion halfway to the moon. I also met Jack Fisher, who's was a current astronaut. He's now over at the Space Force. I was speaking at a seminar in Washington in front of a bunch of Air Force brass, talked about my admiration for the astronauts, and a general came up to me and said, after I was done, he said, do you know that one of the people in your audience, Mr. Cutler, is an astronaut who just came back from the space station? He did some spacewalks. I said, you've got to be kidding. And it was Jack Fisher. We took a photograph together. These guys were my heroes. I mentioned I had cancer. To cheer me up, my wife bought me two things because she knew that it would make me feel, you know, better. She got me a poster autographed by Buzz Aldrin from Apollo 11 and a model of the X-1, the airplane that broke the sound barrier, autographed by Chuck Yeager, the man who flew that mission. And I went out and bought a model of the P-51 Mustang with which he became an ace during the Second World War that he also autographed. I'm looking at them right now. I'm sitting in my office in my house, the house my parents bought when I was 11 years old. I'm truly home when I sit in this office. It used to be my bedroom, and a couple of my kids slept in this room, but it's now my office. So I'm truly home sitting here. And so these were my heroes growing up. And so it's about what we value. And when we're told that we need to bring in foreign workers to do the work Americans are too stupid or too lazy to do, my head wants to explode. America leads the world. And you've got crooked politicians, forgive the redundancy in that statement, crooked politicians saying, we need to bring in the world's best and brightest. Look, if you want to bring in exceptional people, the Elon Musks and the Albert Einsteins, absolutely I'm in favor of it. But when you bring in hundreds of thousands of foreign high-tech workers, these aren't exceptional people. The only thing exceptional about them is they're willing to work for exceptionally low wages under exceptionally adverse conditions so we can destroy the wages of American workers. That's what this is about. This is greed run amok. So Bezos goes out there, does that rocket launch, and with these terrible tornadoes, and I hope that all of these folks my gosh, they're in our thoughts and prayers. What a disaster. So Bezos' plant has its roof ripped off. Six of his employees are dead. Others are missing. And Bezos decides to have a cocktail party or whatever, a celebration because of his launch. What he should have done, you do the launch. It was scheduled. That's fine. You take care of business. And then you hop on one of the airplanes this gazillionaire has, the guy that has more money than some countries, and you fly out there to see how you help the people who are suffering or the families of those who died working for you. But of course he didn't do that because he's Bezos. It almost sounds like an illness, you know? It sounds like a virus, Bezos. What a disgusting sound. What a disgusting human being, to be blunt about it.
The plural of bozo.
Right? Remember the Zika virus? We have the Bezo virus? I mean, goodness gracious. You would think that somebody with his wherewithal would have immediately run to see how he could be helpful to the people that work for him. You would think.
Yes, you would. And I agree with you totally. And in a way, you know, these tech guys, Bezos, and I was trying to think of the other guy,
Musk. But Musk comes
Bezos, Elon Musk, the guy from Twitter, Jack Dorsey, he just stepped down recently.
Oh, another one. Oh, my gosh.
They're like robber barons from the Victorian age.
Oh, steroids. Steroids. Yeah, and then you've got Zuckerberg and Facebook, and you got Bill Gates, another one.
Right, exactly.
Bill Gates reminds me of a villain from one of the James Bond movies, I swear. You know, and again, this brings me back to the fact that as human beings, what do we value? Who do we value? My father had an eighth grade education, and he was a tradesman. My mother had a fourth grade education, came here and lived by herself in a rooming house. That's why when I hear about white privilege, my head explodes. She lived by herself in a rooming house at the age of 13. Imagine living in a country where you couldn't speak the language and she had to support herself at 13. She worked in a sweatshop making umbrellas for $3 a week and still sent some pennies home to her mother in Poland until her mother said, don't put any money in the envelope. They're stealing the money in the post office. And by the time she was in her 20s with a fourth grade education, my mom became the chief buyer for a dress company that during the Depression was so successful that her boss became one of Roosevelt's dollar-a-year men, advising Roosevelt on how to jumpstart the economy. And when they asked him how he became so successful, the guy was making millions in the Depression. Think about that. He would point at my mother in her 20s with a fourth grade education, who spoke with an accent but spoke English quite well with an accent, as did most of her friends. And he said, my chief buyer is a big part of the reason I'm so successful. And he would point at my mother. And my dad was a tradesman. And he started working as a tradesman when he was a kid to help support his family. And I'm going to tell you something. Tradesmen are the backbone of America. Tradesmen are the people who build the buildings and the highways and the railroads. And without tradesmen, we'd all be living under trees somewhere in a forest. And somehow we have this mistaken notion that your wealth is reflected in the size of your bank account somehow. And I have to tell you, with a couple of exceptions, most of the super wealthy are among the most despicable human beings you could ever imagine. And Chris Rock made a great point. He said, you show me somebody with great wealth, and I'll show you evidence of a great crime. Okay? So what do we value?
Yeah.
What do we value? I'll tell you what I value. I value, and Frank Sinatra did a whole bunch of songs, and he talked about this in one of his albums, and he brought tears to my eyes because I kept seeing my dad's face. The last time I was with my father, he was 19. We found out my mom had breast cancer a week before I turned 19 years old, and 3 months later, my dad came to the breakfast table. And I was an only child. It was just me and my mom and dad. Came to the breakfast table with laryngitis. And I said, Dad, are you okay? And he said, oh, I got some laryngitis. Nothing hurts. I'm fine. Well, it wasn't laryngitis. It turned out it was lung cancer. So they were both dying at the same time. I cared for both of them while going to school and working. And I still have nightmares about it, and I don't mind telling you that. And I tell you that not because I'm looking for anyone's sympathy, because wherever you go, there's stories just like this. We love watching Shark Tank. It's an interesting program. And it turns out that just about all those sharks started out in poverty. Mark Cuban started out going door-to-door selling magazines, you see. So I don't measure a person's wealth by their bank account. I measure a person's wealth by their character. Is he a stand-up guy or a stand-up woman? Do they have moral principles? Do they show compassion? See, my parents gave me some very strict rules. My father said to me, you are not allowed to engage in gossip. Both of my parents are very strong on that. My mother said, that's common. That's disgusting. That's low. Your business has nothing to do with their business and vice versa. And my father said, you live and let live. And he said, Mike, when you have a roof over your head, a couple of nice suits hanging in the closet, a car in the driveway with a full tank of gas, and a refrigerator with food enough for several days. Do you know what time it is? I said, what does that have to do with time? He said, I'll tell you what it has to do with time. Because when you're in that situation, it's the time for you to knock on your neighbor's door and see what he needs. Think about that. I remember sitting in a restaurant. I was 15 or 16 years old. my dad was working on the hangars for TWA, those of you old enough to remember Trans World Airlines. When I worked at Kennedy Airport as an inspector, we jokingly called them Teeny Weeny Airlines, TWA. And so he was working on a hangar that they were building for the new jet planes, the 707s that were just coming into service at the time. And I've always been an airplane nut. I used to drag my parents to the airport when I was a kid. My original dream was to be an aerospace engineer. Two of my boys are engineers now, not aerospace, but they're mechanical engineers, because I think I inspired them. You know, I kind of prodded them in that direction. Parents aren't supposed to tell their kids what to do with their lives, but you try to show them opportunities and possibilities. And that's what I did for all four of my kids. And two of them were really into math and science, and it's a really great fit. But I went with my dad to work because this was on a Sunday. I remembered like yesterday. He was working some overtime, and I was excited because if I could go with him, I could sit in that hangar as it was being built, and I could watch the airplanes landing and taking off because the hangar is right next to the active runways. I mean, this is, you know, heaven for me. I did a little single-engine flying as a kid. When I got older, I flew Pipers and a couple of Cessnas. Never got my license, but I logged 20-odd hours of solo time. I've always been fascinated by aviation. I went down to the Cape to see the last moon launch. So I went with my dad, all excited. We're going to go to Kennedy Airport. We're going to watch those new jet planes take off. And I'm ecstatic. And it was pouring out, and there was this little greasy spoon diner not far from the airport. There was a line of people. So they let everybody in so they wouldn't come out of the rain. So we were sitting at tables that had to be cleaned. And the place was packed because it was pouring like crazy. There's a lot of construction workers, all kinds of people in this diner waiting to get their tables cleaned so they could order food and have breakfast. And this poor busboy was running around from table to table to table, and he's running like crazy, and he was just overwhelmed. When I say busboy, he wasn't a boy. He was probably about 30 years old. And at one point, he went whizzing by our table, and I yelled at him, "Hey, you!" And I looked over at my father, and my father had that look. And it was the, "Oh, boy, am I in a deep hole now" look, okay? And in those days, you'd get slapped. It was a different era. I'm 73 True. Years old. Back then, it was not unusual for a father to slap you if you were being a fool. And he had that look on his face, and I'm thinking, I better duck. But he looked at me and he said, who in the world is Hey You? I said, "Dad, he's only a busboy. We need to get this table cleaned. I'm starving, and you got to go to work." He said, "And so you think you have the right to call that guy Hey You, and he's only a busboy?" He said, "Do you know that man is entitled to more respect than a doctor?" And I looked at my father. I said, "You got to be kidding me." He said, "You don't understand?" I said, "No." He said, "Good, that I'm going to talk and you're going to zip it." And when my dad talked to me that way, I knew I'd get slapped. And he wasn't an abusive parent. I don't want anyone getting the wrong idea. But again, it was a very different era going back to that day and age. And I said, "Well, explain it to me. I'm listening." He said, "A doctor makes very good money and they do God's work. If they're really good, they save lives. They eliminate suffering. They get people out of wheelchairs and help them to walk. They do miracles, but they're rewarded. They work hard. They study hard. They spend a fortune on their education, but it pays off for them. They drive new Cadillacs or new Lincolns. Back then, there were no BMWs or Lexus. This is the 60s. And he said, "Wherever they go, they will always have a table for them at the restaurant. Even if they have to bring out a table because he's a famous surgeon or he's a famous neurologist or whatever he does. And women are all over them, and they go to these wonderful conferences, and they live well." And he said they're entitled to live well because they've worked hard their whole lives to build that life for themselves and their families, but they get all the respect they should have, and that's fine. He said, "But that busboy that you just spoke down to does a job you wouldn't do in a million years, and he doesn't make the kind of money a doctor does. In fact, he doesn't probably not only have a Cadillac, he doesn't have a car." He said, "I'm willing to bet that that poor guy walks to this restaurant every day to save the bus fare because for him, every penny counts. And he's going to clean up the mess. You're going to make shoveling food down your throat, and you have the brass to call him Hey You?" He said, "The only person you can talk to that way is a criminal if he can run fast enough afterwards. I don't care if he's spitting the thug's eye. We never imagined I'd be a law enforcement officer one day. My dream was to be an engineer. But he said, that guy does an honest day's work for an honest day's pay, and it has to get your respect. It's not optional. I said, I never thought of it that way. He said, well, now you can think of it that way. And he said, oh, and one more thing, Mike. I said, what's that, Dad? He said, you do know that man's name. And I thought my father had lost it. I said, wait a minute. I never saw that guy before in my life. How in the world should I know his name? And my father hesitated for just that tiny moment, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, Mike, that guy's name is Sir. And he said it just like that. And you know what? He was right. That man's name was Sir. Now, you tell me who is a more decent human being. A guy like Bezos, who cancels the health insurance for his part-time workers, even though he's the wealthiest man on the planet? Or a guy like my dad, who set me straight when I was young and stupid? Because my father's values were the values I wish everybody had. What do you think of that statement, James?
I think it's spot on. You know, when the question you asked earlier was, what do we value? And today, what is valued are those things that are tangible, aren't they?
Yep.
That's right. We value possessions, acquisition. Yep. We value money. We value cars. We value all these things. And when we go back to the beginning of the program and we talk about empathy and some sympathy and some simple human kindness towards one another,
yep.
There's very little of that value. There's very little of that today.
So now imagine I write an article about immigration and some yo-yo makes a comment that, oh, the Democrats and their bleeding hearts. So my question is, who do you want for a friend? And I think that so many people think they're being compassionate because we have been intimidated into believing things that aren't true, just the same way that Madoff swindled people out of their life savings. The politicians today and the media today are swindling Americans out of their future and their lives. We flood America with narcotics. Last year, over 100,000 died of opiate overdoses. We have a wide open border. Joe Biden could care less, but let's be very honest. Neither party cares to secure that border. When Trump wanted to build the border wall, Republicans were in control. Did they give him the money for the wall? Of course not. And they called it the wall of hate. The wall of hate. All kinds of crazy accusations. You know, the border wall is not designed to stop anybody from entering the United States. When I tell this to people, they look at me like I'm crazy. I may be crazy, but I'm not wrong. The border wall does not block ports of entry. All that the border wall was designed to do is to make certain that everybody who wants to enter the United States comes through a port of entry, period. When you go to the baseball park or you go to a football stadium, there's a big fence around the playing field, right, so that nobody can interfere with the game. When you enter the stadium or the park, you have to go through gates, just the way you go through ports of entry. Why? Well, you have to buy a ticket. And in this wacky era, they want to put you perhaps through a metal detector to make sure that you don't have a weapon, to make sure everyone is safe, which is cool. I have no problem with that. But there's an orderly process where you go through the gates, and then you go to your assigned seat, and you behave yourself in the stands, and you can enjoy the game. Is that not a reasonable analogy for what's conducted at ports of entry by having people go through an orderly process at a port of entry? Would anybody accuse the people that own the football stadium of being anti-fan by making them go through gates?
No.
What do you think of that analogy, James?
We got to have order.
Is that a reasonable analogy?
Absolutely it is. Right. And the thing that bothers me about it, and you know, and we've talked about this, Michael, for 2 years. And it's basically from the time Joe Biden took his hand off the Bible, our southern border has been wide open. And I'm sure, and we don't talk about it that much, you and I have, but I'm sure that our border with Canada isn't any different.
No, and you've got people coming in at international airports. We've got 95,000 miles of coastline. So here's the thing that really would solve the problem, but we've never done it because they don't want the problem solved. Who's they? The banks, Wall Street, the cretins like Bezos and Gates and Zuckerberg, all these globalists. You can't control the border at the border. This may sound shocking, but again, I've been at this for a long time, and I've had the opportunity to consider this from various aspects. And, you know, I've testified before something like 17 congressional hearings in both the House and Senate. And I gave testimony to the 9/11 Commission. I've also testified before state legislative hearings around the country and, in some cases, city legislative hearings. And I remember sitting in Washington doing a closed-door session with a bunch of members of Congress and their staffers. It wasn't a hearing. So I was really happy because a hearing is ridiculous. Now, why do I call it ridiculous? You get to speak for 5 minutes, then they shut you up. Imagine if we conducted criminal trials that way. It doesn't make any sense. It's all a show. They really should charge admission like a Broadway show, right? Do you really want the truth, or do we just want to, you know, go through the motions of nonsense? In fact, I don't know if I ever told you the story. I'll make it quick. I'm looking at the clock. The time goes so quickly when I'm on with you, James. I love doing your show. But I was heading to Washington, and this was about 2 years after the attacks of 9/11. And 9/11 was very personal for me. I'm a New Yorker. Those ashes landed on my house. My neighbors died. So as an American, I was enraged. But as a New Yorker, this really literally hit close to home. Ground Zero is less than 10 miles from where I live. And the World Trade Center was a major part of my day. I had a desk at the post office when I was working with ATF. I had desks at various federal buildings because I was part of the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force. So I had a desk at the FBI, a desk at DEA, a desk at ATF. I worked with city and state police. I worked with foreign governments. I wasn't just sitting in the immigration office. And the post office where ATF had their offices was right across the street from the World Trade Center. And I would go into the Trade Center at least once a day. They had banks in there. They had shops in there. They had restaurants. Customs was there. Other agencies were there. So I was in and out of that building going to meetings and so forth. So it's not just a building in my city. It's a building that I was in at least several times a week. It's like someone blowing up my living room. And so, you know, this was really very, very personal for me when 9/11 took place. And, you know, so you look at 9/11, and I was enraged. And I was gratified that they had called me to testify at a bunch of hearings. In fact, one of the hearings is now available, the video on C-SPAN as part of their permanent library, because I was requested, by the way, by Sheila Jackson Lee and Jim Sensenbrenner, the Republican chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Sheila Jackson Lee, that ranking Democrat in the Immigration Subcommittee at the time, because two of the dead terrorists were discovered to have been granted permission to, of all things, go to flight school 6 months after the attack. So they were dead. The world knew they were terrorists. And the flight school gets notification that these two students are authorized to attend flight school. Picture that one, Rudy Decker in Florida. So, you know, I did that hearing, and I did other hearings. And I'm on my way down to Washington, and picture this phone conversation. I'm on the phone with the chief counsel for the Republicans in the House Judiciary Committee. And he gets me on the phone, and he has a slight Baltimore accent. And I had family in Baltimore, and I this almost sort of southern accent, but not quite. He says to me, "Mike Cutler," I just went over your testimony. It runs 8.5 minutes, but you're only getting 5 minutes. So by the time you get down here, y'all going to have to figure out what you want to remove from your prepared remarks in front of the committee. Now I'm on the Jersey Turnpike heading south, going about 65 miles an hour. And I said, "Well, I understand that I normally get 5 minutes." He says, "Look, Mike, we'll put all of your testimony in the congressional record. Hell, we'll put a phone book in the congressional record for you if you want it. But you're just getting 5 minutes." And something snapped. Something snapped. I got nuts. I really did. And I said, "Let me see if I understand this. Just a couple short years ago, scumbags from the Middle East who shouldn't have been in our country in the first place turned passenger airliners into cruise missiles and took roughly 3,000 lives, and more people will undoubtedly die in the years to come because of illness, because of the toxins they've been exposed to. They've altered the world. We've lost so many of our constitutional protections in the name of national security, and I'm worried very much about something Ben Franklin said, that if you're willing to exchange freedom for security, you'll probably have neither. And I said, so now I'm on my way to Washington to testify at a hearing to help America prevent future attacks. And all you can focus on is that I'm going to need an extra 3.5 minutes to speak. Am I getting this right? Or am I mistaken? And I said, I don't give a damn if you put the entire Library of Congress into the congressional record. The news media is going to be there. In those days, I was on with Lou Dobbs at least once a week, sometimes twice a week. I knew CNN was going to be covering the hearing. I knew the newspapers were going to be there. And I said, the average American has no interest in reading the congressional record. They're going to come home from work. They're going to turn on the television. And if they can hear me saying what I'm saying, they will become educated. They're not going to go digging for the congressional record. He said, well, that's true. I said, okay, and you have a problem that I'm going to speak for an extra 3.5 minutes when nothing less than national security and the lives of Americans are hanging in the goddamn balance? Are you serious? Are you drunk? I said, you know, there is so much hot air emanating from Washington, D.C., that if I could pipe that hot air up to New York during the next blizzard, we'd have no need for salt to clear the roads of ice. Picture that in your mind. I said, so with all the hot air coming from your neck of the woods, an extra 3.5 minutes for me to say what needs to be said is more than you can tolerate. I said, so I'll make you a deal. I said, I am now 12 miles from the next exit, and at the speed I'm going, that's about 10 minutes from now. If I can't deliver my prepared testimony as I wrote it, put the whole damn thing in the congressional record, and I will do a U-turn when I get to the next exit. I'm going to go home, take off my necktie, kick off my shoes, and pour myself another cup of coffee. And I hung up on him. And then I sat there thinking, what did I just do? So I'm driving along, scared to death that I just torpedoed everything, but I thought I was right. And sometimes a real man or a real woman has to stick up for what you believe is right. We don't teach that to our kids, but I do. I was taught that by my parents. They were giants. I hope I'm one-third the parent to my kids they were to me. Well, after about 6 minutes, the phone rings, and he said, the boss, and that meant Jim Sensenbrenner, the boss says Cutler gets 8 minutes and 30 seconds, but not 1 second more. Now, but I tell you the story because I'm tired of the games, James. And that's why I flew into that rage. I mean, this wasn't a hearing about the rules for tiddlywinks, or maybe we're going to modify baseball so there's 4 outs instead of 3 outs. We're talking about strategies to keep America safe, and all that those dim bulbs could think about was Cutler's going to speak for an extra 3.5 minutes. What happened to this country? Again, I'm going to ask you this perhaps rhetorically. Am I crazy?
No. No, those people in Washington would gladly, on either side, there are folks on either side that are so power mad and drunk with ambition and maintaining what power they have and cultivating more, would happily sacrifice this country on their own altar, either of their ideology or their ambition.
Now, to be honest, this guy's a real good guy, but they all play by these little games that they play. It's all about playing games. I'm not into playing games. I'm into achievement. I'm into real-world goals. Now, they had the guts and the spine back then to take on George W. Bush, because Bush was the adversary to secure borders and effective immigration. He violated the Homeland Security Act when he created DHS, the Department of Homeland Surrender, as I came to call it. So to have Republicans stand up against a Republican president, you know, my phone conversations very often were almost funny, but not much so. And I kind of took it for granted. My wife was kind of amazed. I was sitting in the car. I had a speakerphone in my car. I had to buy a device. They didn't make them in those days, but I put in a speakerphone in my car. So we're driving along and the phone rings, and it's the same guy. It was a different hearing. And he calls me up, and I said, if you're calling me, he must have done it again. What now? And who was I talking about? W. Bush. And he just roared with laughter. He said, you're not going to believe what he just did. And we're willing to hold a hearing if you're willing to come to Washington. So I was working well and working closely with them. But they are so caught up in these games and cutting out little paper dolls, and we have this rule and that rule. And at some point, someone needs to look at the bigger picture and ask, what the hell are we doing? And every American should be united behind what we're fighting for, not because I'm so brilliant and wonderful that I'm always right. No, I'm not always right. But if you look at the immigration laws as they stand, and I recommend that everybody go to Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182. I'm going to say it again, and you can find the links in my articles, because I always like to put this in, because it shows that this isn't about race or religion or ethnicity. If those laws were about that, James, I couldn't enforce those laws for 30 seconds, let alone 30 years. It starts out, this is Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182, 1182. Aliens who have dangerous communicable diseases. Think about COVID. Okay? Aliens who are severely mentally ill and are violent. Aliens who are criminals and terrorists and human rights violators and fugitives from justice, human traffickers, drug smugglers. Okay? People who would become a public charge or if they work would displace American workers. That's what's in the law. Who could be opposed to that? And then we always hear this BS, oh, what they're doing is unconstitutional. Trump is unconstitutional. Really? Article 4, Section 4 of the United States Constitution says that the states are to be provided with a Republican form of government and protected from invasion or domestic violence. I would argue that the chaos on the border is nothing short of an invasion. So when you hear this crap, oh, what they're doing is unconstitutional. The Remain in Mexico policy, another court just upheld it, by the way. Oh, these poor people, if they go back to their home countries, they're going to be killed. Well, first of all, we don't know that. Second of all, this isn't like, well, I can't live in El Salvador, so I'm going to pick the United States. No, the idea is once you leave El Salvador, you go to Mexico, you're not in El Salvador. So whatever reason that you are claiming political asylum just went away. And political asylum doesn't mean economics. There's no such thing as economic asylum because half the world would qualify for economic asylum. I did a little bit of reading. Do you know that there's probably about 1 billion people who don't have electricity? I mean, that's poor. They can't turn on a light. That's poor. All right? So are they all supposed to come to America? I mean, that's nuts. All right? But again, people are well-intentioned. They say, oh, my God, they live under the – so let's let them come here. And then people say to me, look how big America is. Look at those vast plains. And we could build buildings. And they're being compassionate. And instead of ridiculing them, because if you talk to your friends over the holidays, they're going to tell you things like that. And I've heard all these arguments. And you say to them, well, and I had this argument with a lawyer that I was on a program with. We were in opposition. And I drove her home afterwards. It was the dead of winter. We were in New Jersey. She lived in New York. I live in New York. The roads were covered with ice. It took me 2 hours to drive her home, so I had a captive audience for a conversation. And by the time I brought her to her front door, she actually came to agree with me, James, because she said to me, we're such a big country, 3,000 miles coast to coast. I remember I was with the Israeli police general. I worked very closely with them because my first fraud case caused me to uncover a terror plot in Israel. We prevented the bombing of an oil refinery. I was told I was the only American law enforcement official who was not only allowed to walk through their consulate in New York without an escort, but with my firearm. I worked very closely with the Israelis. And several times we sent people back home to stand trial for murder and other very serious crimes. And they were always there for us. Whatever we needed in the way of intelligence, you name it, they provided. They actually sent Israeli police officers to sit on wiretaps here in the United States when we targeted an Israeli-based drug trafficking organization, because our translators would never have understood the slang used by the criminals. Their police officers certainly did. So they sent a half dozen Israeli police detectives to the United States. That was the relationship that I had. And so, you know, the idea is that we need to work with our allies to protect each other. What we're doing is undermining America and undermining our allies, because you have crooks running the show right now. So I was with this young lady, and I'm driving her back, and she said, look at this thing. Oh, and by the way, the reason I mentioned the Israelis, because I remember one day he told me that he had to fly to California, and he said he couldn't believe the scope, the magnitude of America. He said, when you take off from Israel, Israel is about the size of the state of New Jersey. He said, you take off in an airliner, and within 15 minutes, you're flying over another country. He said, Mike, he said, I flew to California. For 5 hours, I'm flying over the United States. I look out the left window, I look out the right window, and as far as I could see and beyond is America. He said, as an Israeli, it blows my mind. He said, I can't even wrap my brain around the size of your country. And he said, that doesn't include Alaska. It doesn't include Hawaii. It doesn't include Puerto Rico. He said, your country goes on forever. It's like half the world. And a lot of people get caught up in that. And they said, well, look how big America is. To this young lady, and this is about 2 years after 9/11, I said, how many people do you think can come to America? She says, well, easily we could have another 50 million. I said, okay. Could we have 100 million? She said, probably. I said, do you understand that people need more than a bed to sleep in? You can build all the housing you want, but every person who's here has an ecological footprint. And that was the topic of my most recent article for Front Page Magazine, by the way. The title, and I want everyone to check it out after the program, and please forward the link to everybody. Be part of my Bucket Brigade of Truth. My article was entitled, Environmental Impact Study Must Precede Build Back Better. Bill's immigration amnesty would devastate the U.S. ecology and the U.S. economy. Because every person in the country has an environmental footprint. Everybody needs water. And I started doing some research. Do you know that the average person needs a minimum of 85 gallons of water every day? Not just for drinking, but for cooking and sanitary purposes. There's a drought in the West. 60 Minutes just did an amazing story about how riverbeds are drying up. There's a drought in the West. And we're bringing in millions of people, and every person needs 85 gallons of water per day. Bring in a million people, you're talking about 85 million gallons of water per day. Every person needs sewerage. Every person needs food. It requires acres of land to grow enough food to sustain one person. And that land, by the way, needs irrigation on top of it. So now how much more water are we talking about? Every person needs electricity. And we want to stop burning fossil fuels. How does that work out? Everybody needs transportation. Everybody needs health care. If we bring children in, they need to go to school. The Congressional Budget Office back in 2006 estimated that it costs 20 to 40% more to educate kids who can't speak, read, or write English. Now let's start crunching the numbers. So I told this young lady, I said, so how do you plan to grow all the food and provide all the water and all the electricity and all the other infrastructure? And by the way, when you put more cars on the road, you get more congestion. Now, what does that lead to? More pollution and less efficient use of the fossil fuels that are still being used by the cars and the trucks and the buses, because when the roads are jammed up, you burn fuel and go nowhere. So congestion goes up, quality of life goes out the window, and we wind up with more pollution. And we wind up burning more fuel, and it's totally inefficient. And then because everybody who's here needs housing and clothing and all and food, inflation kicks in because this is supply and demand. Suddenly you have millions of more people looking to buy consumables. Housing goes up because as we flood the market with foreign workers, the value of labor goes down. American workers get displaced. But because everyone needs to sleep somewhere, the price of housing goes up. Guess what that leads to? Homelessness. And if you don't believe me, look at the tent cities that we're seeing across the country. And, of course, these glib wiseasses, oh, these are all people with mental illness or they're drug addicts. Well, some of them might be, but many of them are middle-class workers who lost their jobs because of nothing they did wrong. In fact, Dan Rather did an amazing documentary just about 10 years ago called No Thanks for Everything. Go look it up, No Thanks for Everything. I've included the link in some of my articles. He interviewed four computer programmers who had MBAs in computer science. They were all honors graduates. They had worked for decades in the field, came to work one day, and were told to pack up their office and go home. They were no longer needed except to train their replacements from India. So these people that were making solid middle-class salaries are now unemployed, and nobody wants to hire them because they're in their 50s. They lost their homes to foreclosure. And this woman sitting in the car next to me is looking at me with her mouth hanging open. And I said, but let's say I agree with you and we can bring 200 million people to America. I'm going to be an optimist. Can we bring 300 million, 500 million? How about a billion? She said, well, let's not get ridiculous. Of course we can't bring a billion. I said, okay. So now we're not even having an argument about whether or not we need to be able to stop immigration. You've just agreed with me that we need to be able to stop immigration at some point. It's like the old Johnny Carson joke where he asked some starlet, would you go to bed with a man for $1 million? She says, well, it would depend on the man. He says, how about $5 million? She says, look, for $5 million, I could probably go to bed with anybody. He said, how about $10? She said, are you crazy? What do you think I am? He said, well, we've already established what you are. Now we're just dickering over price. How's that?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. I like to interject a little levity because, you know, if we lose our sense of humor, our minds can't be far behind. But that's the case here. So even she said that there would be a point when we would have to turn off the flow of people into the country. I said, how do you plan to do it if you're not willing to do it now or even create a mechanism to do it? And who gives you the right to say $1 billion and someone else says $800 million? Are you God? By the time we got to her house, she said to me, you've thoroughly rattled my cage. I don't have any answers for you. Now, I'm telling you the story, folks, because when you're having dinner for Christmas or New Year's or whatever, because this is a season for getting together, raise these questions. And when someone says that I feel bad for these people, don't look at them and say, what are you, a bleeding heart? I feel bad for these people. You know, I have a confession. I lost three people, and they'd spent time at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. And if you want to know what hell looks like, it's the waiting room where everyone sits and waits for words from the operating room. And some people get great news. They're jumping up and down, and they're crying, and they're thanking God. And other people are getting horrific news, and they're in the fetal position, rolling on the floor, screaming. I still have nightmares about that room. And for years, I couldn't drive by the hospital, because every time I drove by the hospital, I would get physically sick to the point that I wanted to throw up. It took me at least 20 years before I could drive by that hospital. I'm being honest. I have post-traumatic stress from all this stuff. We all go through hell. We all have things that happened in our lives where everything was wonderful one day and the next day they pulled the building out from under us. And when people tell you that they feel bad or they have feelings or whatever, these are the people that you probably became friends with because you admired their compassion. You admired that they have big hearts. And now you're going to turn around and say, oh, they're ruled by their feelings. I hope so. I hope so. Who do you want for a friend? But the trick is they need to understand that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. If you're in a lifeboat and it's filled to capacity and there are people in the water and the water is frigid and the sharks are circling, you want to bring those people into the boat. Of course you do. What kind of person wouldn't? The dilemma is if you do, your lifeboat is going to sink. Are you a bad person because you feel bad for the people in the water? See, my point is, when we speak to our neighbors who disagree and they talk about how we're being cold-hearted, explain to them that you need to understand limitations. When my parents were told they had cancer, my first wife was told she had cancer, the first thing you say to the doctor is, there's got to be something you can do. First thing you say, there's got to be something. And they look you in the eye and they said, no, there is nothing we can do. Not a good day. It's the day I hope never comes for anybody listening to this program tonight. But tragically, that day will come for all of us one way or another under whatever circumstances. So when you deal with realism, then you realize that sometimes there are no good solutions. And you want to believe that a country will look out for its own children and its own citizens before we look out for anybody else. If, God forbid, you got a phone call that there was a tragedy in your child's school, there was a fire, and you run into that building, the first person you're going to try to save, if you're normal, is your own child. If you can bring other kids out, of course you're going to. And if you bring your child out and you can go back in and try to save more kids, of course we're going to do that. But as normal people, what do? We try to save our own children. America's kids are suffering. And if you look at what we've done, creating an underclass of poverty, especially in America's minority community, these are desperate people. As an agent, I dealt with those neighborhoods. I didn't read about it or drive by. I was in those buildings making arrests, conducting investigations. And you realize that these kids start out with three strikes against them. Frigid temperatures in the wintertime with no heat. Rats, not mice, rats running through the buildings. Insects infesting the house. You flip on a light switch, you can't even see the wall because the bugs go in every direction. The stench of poverty stays in your nostrils for weeks. One of my buddies, when he retired, said to me, Mike, the one thing I won't miss, I'm going to miss working with you and all the other guys. It's like a big family, but I won't miss the stench of poverty. And I knew exactly what he was talking about. So when we raise American children and tell them, if you're of color, the white people are preventing you from being successful, that's what the Germans were told about the Jews. You would be successful if it weren't for the Jews. Of course, they didn't mention to these same Germans that maybe if you stopped hanging out in the beer gardens and went to work in the morning, you could do better for yourself. So they scapegoat one against the other, and now you have conflict. And the Holocaust was the result. So now we're being told, because of white privilege and all this other nonsense, and the reality is the schools are crumbling. The resources aren't there. We keep spending ever more money on English as a second language rather than putting in new labs. We overcrowd the schools, and there's a sense of hopelessness because even if you get that degree in engineering, you have a 50-50 chance of not getting the job because we're going to look to bring in people from some third world country who will work for one-third the normal wage. So we're destroying opportunities for Americans where we are devaluing citizenship. In New York, the lunatics running my city have just passed a bill to allow non-citizens to vote in municipal elections, which is insane.
Ugh.
You have mobs rioting and doing the smash and grab robberies. Oh, we've got to be compassionate. We can't put people in jail. But at the same time, what is Biden trying to do? Hire an army of auditors and agents for the IRS to imprison Americans who don't pay their taxes. And we're going to go as low as $600. Forget $10,000. $600. We're going to squeeze every American or put them in jail or do other things to them because we need the money to do what? Import how many more people into the United States? A limitless number. This is a violation of the 9/11 Commission. Now, I wrote a couple of articles, one, environmental impact study must precede Build Back Better. A week earlier, or 2 weeks earlier, I did another article, Biden's Build Back Better speeds the fencing of America. In law enforcement, the term fence is someone who sells stolen property. They're selling the future of our children and our country. And then I write for U.S. Incorporated, usinc.org, and the article titled in that piece, Massive amnesty and Build Back Better would fulfill Pelosi's dream of transforming America. And she was out on TV the other day, again, the Wicked Witch of the West. You want to talk about cold-hearted, standing in front of a freezer with ice cream? Her heart is as cold as that freezer chest. She has a freezer chest, thinking about it. That was the night when people didn't know if they could get food to feed their children, and she's showing off her $20 a pint ice cream. Where was her compassion? You want to talk about cold-hearted. So who gave her permission to transform America? We hire politicians to be the stewards of our country. You go to a hotel, they give you the room to the hotel that you've just rented, and you sign some documents, whether you know it or not. What you're signing is, if I damage anything, I've bought it. Maybe we should do that with these politicians. If you damage it, we're going to hold you accountable. This is going to be transformational, Build Back Better. Transformational, what do you mean? What are you transforming? From what into what? Well, what nobody in the mainstream media is talking about, that includes Fox News. Let's be blunt about it. There were days I was a regular at Fox. Nobody wants to talk about immigration. They all breathlessly, all these journalists, I don't care how conservative they are, will go up to some politician breathlessly, how soon will you pass comprehensive immigration reform and solve the problem? Pass comprehensive reform. I called it the Terrorist Assistance and Facilitation Act because it would require adjudicating millions of applications. So that means there's no interviews or no field investigations possible. Immigration fraud, people lying on those applications, was identified by the 9/11 Commission as the key method of entry and embedding for the terrorists. Now, they say the system is broken. Why would you take a broken system, you know, going back to talking about flying, before you get in an airplane and take off, you pre-flight the airplane. You walk around the airplane. You check to make sure the control surfaces are all properly attached and they all work properly. You drain a little fuel out to make sure there's no water or sediment in the fuel. You don't want the engine going dead at 10,000 feet. Then you get into the airplane and you check out the magnetos and the fuel pumps and all the other systems. Takes about a half hour before you go fly. You don't just jump into an airplane like a car and take off. Well, we've pre-flighted the immigration system, and it fails and fails and fails and fails again. In fact, the 9/11 Commission identified immigration fraud as the key vulnerability. So we're going to have a massive program to enable millions of people to come to America, get lawful status, and we'll have no idea who they are. And the article stated that Pelosi said that because the Congressional Budget Office estimated that 6.5 million aliens would take part in a massive amnesty program. The publication The Hill talked about it. PBS and these other networks didn't even talk about immigration. And if you look at immigration, this by itself is enough justification to shred this bill and put it in a garbage can and never allow it to see light of day again. The CBO is claiming 6.5 million aliens. Based on what? I have no idea. And the aliens would have to have entered the United States prior to 2011. Okay. So here's the question. How do you figure out how long an illegal alien has been living here if you can't interview them and you can't do a field investigation? Think about it. The answer is it's a requirement that means nothing. Because there's no reason why some alien can't come to America 8 months from now. They're not even here yet. They haven't even decided if they want to come here because this country is turning into a disaster. But let's say 8 months from now they come here and they fill out an application and they say, I entered the United States in 2009 by running the border. If you run the border, you don't create a record of entry. How do you refute their claim that they've been here since 2009? Many illegal aliens use multiple false identities. And in fact, Alejandro Mayorkas, the guy that runs DHS, when he ran Citizenship and Immigration Services for Obama, was accused of ordering people to approve applications for visas that were inappropriate. The FBI and Homeland Security warned them to not approve applications from a particular company because it had a nexus to Iranian terrorist groups. Guess what? He ordered and had all their applications approved even after the FBI said you shouldn't do this. You're endangering national security. Now he's running Homeland Security, and he just issued a statement 2 weeks ago that if anybody lies on their application to citizenship, we used to denaturalize them. That's a felony, right? The terrorists lied on their applications for citizenship because citizenship is a major issue. Do you know that when our special forces raided the Bin Laden compound and they seized his library, two items jumped off the sheet when I was looking at part of the inventory? A copy of the 9/11 Commission report. Well, I provided testimony, and it makes sense. You wanted to know how we, you know, what we figured out the vulnerabilities were. They also found an application for citizenship, U.S. citizenship, in the Bin Laden compound. I don't think he was trying to become a citizen, but he was probably trying to get his people to, because if you look at the indictments of a bunch of terrorists who've been arrested over the years, there's been quite a few, they were all told by their handlers overseas, don't do anything until you become a citizen and get that U.S. passport. That's how important it is. Because when an alien naturalizes, they can get a new name. Their U.S. passport only reflects the new name. So basically, we're putting them in their own witness protection program. Think about that. So you have Mayorkas saying, if you lie on your application for citizenship, we don't want you to worry because you're an American and we will protect you. You have nothing to fear. You can lie all you want and you can keep your citizenship. I think he's trying for the MVP award from ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And if you couple this with what happened in Afghanistan,
oh, my gosh.
We've opened the gates to hell. I want to connect the dots here, folks. So Mayorkas has made it clear that fraud is not an issue unless you commit fraud on your tax return. Then we're going to come for you and put you in jail. And we're going to shake you till your pockets are empty. But you lie on immigration documents? That's cool. Come to America. Come one, come all. So 6.5 million could easily become 30 million. But that's not the number, folks. Because they will all have the absolute right to bring their minor children to America and their spouses. And if they each claim to have four kids and we legalize 25 million, we could be talking about an influx of 100 million. And I'm going to tell you what that means. 100 million kids, most of whom can't speak English. Think about the Congressional Budget Office, the impact on education. Our schools will be toast. American children will be done. All right? The economy and the environment will go to hell because every one of those 100 million needs food and water. They need housing. They need transportation. They need health care. Infrastructure will crumble. Inflation will go through the roof because they all need clothing and food and housing and so forth. And when they grow up, they will be part of the labor pool, and the pressure on wages will be through the floorboards. And America could look like Venezuela, and they say, well, we're going to have a sunset clause for taxes. There is no sunset clause for immigration. Once you give someone legal status, unless they commit felonies, they're here forever. So Nancy Pelosi is completely right. She's actually told the truth. The goal, and I believe that they're doing all these other things to distract Americans from immigration, because that's the killer here. Because if we admit 100 million new immigrants, and somebody in one of the comments said, there's no 100 million kids in Latin America, and he's probably right. But the problem is, if you look at who they've been arresting on the border, they're coming from countries from everywhere around the world. That includes countries that sponsor terrorism, countries that are adversaries of the United States. We're being flooded with criminals and narcotics, and the sheer numbers of people would crash the economy, and I think that's really the goal. Most conservatives say, well, the Democrats are importing voters. No, they've gone beyond that. I believe the goal is to crash the economy so that everyone needs to go to the government for a handout. And I remember when I was a kid growing up in Brooklyn, my mom gave me an allowance. But because she gave me the money, she could attach strings. Mike, I don't want you buying more than one comic book a week. Oh, come on, Mom, I like Superman and Batman. No. You got to be reasonable. One or the other. You can't buy both. Now, could she do that? Sure. Why? Because if I didn't do what she said, she could turn off my allowance. Once I got my first job, well, that was a whole other story, because now I was independent. I might take her advice anyway, because I tremendously respected my mom and dad. I miss them terribly. But it's one thing when it's your money. It's something else when it's their money. So when the government gives you money, they can attach all kinds of strings. And if you haven't noticed, they're control freaks. And when you look at a guy like Jerry Nadler, my gosh, Jerry Nadler reminds me of the kid in school that we'd say, hey, let's go play hide and seek. And Jerry would hide, but nobody would look for him. Okay? So now that Jerry Nadler, right? You put people like that in control of the government, and we come back to what Plato had said, right? What did Plato say? One of the penalties for refusing to participate in politics is that you wind up being governed by your inferiors. And when you look at Pelosi and Nadler and Bernie Sanders and Chuck Schumer, what are you looking at? Cretans. Am I wrong?
No, no. It astonishes me that these people, limited as it seems to me, limited as they are, have attained such high position.
Well, Washington, someone once said, Washington is Hollywood for ugly people.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And I wrote an article in the past, I'm going to resurrect the title, Governing Under the Influence. They're governing under the influence of money that they're getting, and they're governing under the influence of power itself because it becomes an intoxicant for mental midgets. Look, we've met cops that shouldn't be cops. Why? Because someone pinned a star on his or her chest, and they didn't have a strong enough character that they could say, well, this is just a job. I'm not going to lord over people. You get some people, you give them a little authority, and they're insufferable. We had a woman in my school, my kid's school, and she became the PA president, and after her, they wanted me, and I did it for a year. But she was like the Wicked Witch of the West, because they would, you know, she would close the doors to the school at 8:45, but if it was driving rain and cars are triple parked, you know, New York is very densely populated, you could be running to the door with your child that's going to kindergarten, a four-year-old, and it's pouring out, and she'd slam the door while looking you in the eye, and you're 8 feet away from her, and now you've got to run all the way around the building to get to the open door. And people said to her, why do you do it? And she would say, because I can. Needless to say, they wanted nothing to do with her after that. But what happened? They gave her a little bit of power. And what's the point of having power if you can't make other people aware of the fact that you have that power over them? And there are some people who don't handle power well. And that's what we're facing. It becomes intoxicating. Power corrupts absolute. Power corrupts absolutely.
Truth.
You know, it's the old nonsense. I would have people come into my booth at the airport. Do you know who I am? And I'd look at them. I'd say, well, if you're asking me that question, you're probably a jackass. You know who I am. I remember I said that to somebody who's a diplomat from Germany. She said to me, I'll have your job. I said, you wouldn't want my job because you'd have to deal with fools like you, and it's not fun. You know? But seriously, how many times have you seen imperious people like that? Large and in charge. Large and
too
in charge.
Many.
Think of Anthony Weiner. Think about the Cuomo brothers. My goodness gracious. My goodness gracious. The Cuomo brothers. That whole routine, right? What nonsense. What chutzpah. And they're shameless. They are as shameless as prostitutes. I swear to God. They're on a power trip. I am large and I'm in charge. Seriously.
And it wasn't through anything that they did. You know what? I mean, you know what I mean? It's not because of anything they did. Their dad was connected. You know?
Yep.
They had an old man that had some juice, and they used it.
Well, and I think that their old man was probably a good guy. I mean, I remember voting for their dad because I thought he was a pretty good governor. And I think the problem with their dad is he was so busy being governor, he forgot to be a father. And I've seen people in my profession that way also. You know, you go up to some guy, hey, Jack, how's things going? Oh, I'm getting ready to arrest this guy next week. Okay, how's your family? Yeah. Family's great. But let me tell you about this case I'm working on.
Yeah.
And then, you know, 3 weeks later, hey, you know what happened to Jack's kid? What? Yeah, he was arrested by the cops. He was doing this, that. Yeah, what? because instead of taking care of being a father, he was 100% of the time agent. Now, we need, I mean, being an agent isn't just a job. It's a way of life. And I'm going to tell you, when you retire and they take the badge away, there's an empty feeling that goes with that. And the way I've always looked at it is, you had a good run. I had 30 years. I mean, I was at war with my agency because I was trying to fix things that were broken, which they didn't want. But the point of the matter is, I was very proud to be a federal agent. I still am proud, and I had a great life. I always wanted a job that made a difference, that would give me an adventure. And I've been out on the water with the Coast Guard doing boardings of ships. I was the Marine Intelligence Officer in New York. I've chased bad guys on rooftops. I've been up in a police chopper. I've been before Congress. It was a great profession. But everything ends. I remember one of the astronauts, who's an old man now, they interviewed him. And he said, well, I'm not the guy who walked on the moon. I'm lucky I could walk in my house, you know. But back then, at some point you have to let go and you have to look back. And, you know, as a kid, I said, if I live my life properly, when I get to where I am right now, in fact, hopefully God will give me enough years that I still have some more adventures ahead of me. But I want to be able to live a life where on a rainy day I could sit back in a nice, comfortable reclining chair, close my eyes, and run memories like a good movie. And there have been some pretty cool adventures. And, again, what constitutes success? There are people not far from where I live that have homes that are worth millions of dollars. I mean, even in New York, the craziness of real estate, my house is probably worth about $1 million, which is nuts. But, I mean, there are people that have houses that are worth 5 and 10 times what my house is worth. And my kids one day said, Dad, are you envious? I said, no, of course not. First of all, I was raised to never be envious of anybody else. Second of all, perhaps to buy that house, that guy owns a business, and every morning at 5 o'clock he had to go into that store and stand in that store until 10 o'clock at night, go home, just barely be able to have dinner, go to sleep, and start the process the next day. And he wakes up one day, 70 years old, and when you ask him where he's been or what he's done, all he could talk about is his adventures inside the confines of that store that took care of his family. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. We need those storekeepers. And if that's your idea of success, then I wish you well. But I couldn't live that life. So what was the trade-off? As a federal agent, you don't buy a Ferrari, right? You don't buy a house that has an elevator in it and a bowling alley in the basement. I'm sorry, you can't do that on a government paycheck. But I lived the life I wanted to. You see, success can only be measured by individuals, and I've never cared what other people thought about me or what my view of success was. I didn't make money going to Congress, but I saw that as a success because after the ashes landed on my house, I was determined, and I told this to my buddies even before that, I'm going to go to Congress. I'm going to get those knuckleheads to listen to me. And they said, you're crazy. You keep talking that way, they're going to take away your security clearance because field agents don't do hearings. And generally, field agents don't do hearings, except I did 17 hearings. So to me, that's a success. Did it put money in my wallet? No. Did I buy a Ferrari the next day? Of course not. But I don't see success, going back to what we've talked about at the beginning, as material. Success is I set goals for myself, and I met or exceeded the goals. One of my friends, in fact, said to me, he said, Mike, you're the only guy I know who set a bunch of goals for yourself, and you had to keep on changing the goals because you kept meeting all the goals you established for yourself. We need to stop worrying how other people see us. We need to learn to stand on our own 2 feet. When I was a kid, I used to get beat up because I was scrawny, and I didn't give a damn who was going to hit home run number 61. I thought it was silly. I mean, you have adults hitting a ball with a stick and everyone's losing their minds over this? Are you crazy? And I was very outspoken. I always had a big mouth. So I would wind up in fistfights until my father said, you're going to go to a gym, you're going to learn to work out, you're going to learn to defend yourself. And today, what did we see happening? Over time, American kids were told, don't defend yourself. Don't stand on your own 2 feet. Don't allow anyone to question the authorities. Follow the science. What science? When I had cancer, my surgeon said to me, before you decide on having me take care of you, I want you to get at least one or two second opinions. Why? The guy was the guy who devised the PSA test. He was the head of urology at a major hospital. He said, because other doctors may have a different way of thinking. We were following the science. There's different physicists with different ideas about string theory and the Big Bang theory and Hawking and other physicists. They don't all see the things the same way. So when people say follow the science, what they're really telling you is follow the indoctrination. I think I may have mentioned it on your program, and I wrote about Albert Einstein. Einstein was forced to flee Germany, and I always knew that. Maybe being a Jew in Germany during the war was not a good thing, not good for your health. But it was beyond that. The Nazis decided to discredit Hitler, and they accused him. I'm sorry, Hitler decided to discredit Albert Einstein. So Hitler got some physicists who were Nazis and gotten the Nobel Prize to refer to Einstein's work as Jewish science and said that he was misleading the German people and he was dangerous to the German people. He was almost killed. There were riots on campuses. It looked just like something out of Antifa today on college campuses. And that's why he fled Germany. By the way, what theories did they attack him for? His theories on relativity. And by the way, the latest scientific journal just talked about how probably the most difficult element of his theories on relativity was just confirmed by modern physicists using the latest equipment. But it was a toxic environment, and they convinced the German people that Hitler's science was wrong science. You're seeing it today with climate change. You're seeing it today with vaccines. You're seeing it with everything. It's a process of indoctrination. We're supposed to question everything that we're told. Now, if you question things, it's considered heresy. You know, we have a new version of papal infallibility. The government said so. Fauci said so, even though Fauci disagrees with himself about six times a week. Right? And so this is where we are today. And that's why what I really want everyone to do over the next couple of weeks, and make this your New Year's resolution, have conversations with your neighbors. Don't be condescending. Don't have fights with them. And this garbage about insulting people because they have feelings and they have emotions. I don't want a friend who doesn't have emotions, okay? Maybe Spock was okay in Star Trek, but in real world, I wouldn't want Spock for a friend. I want friends who have emotions. Men do cry when it's appropriate, okay? So when people start to criticize other people for using their emotions, that's not fair, and that's foolish, and it's counterproductive. What we need to do is accept the idea that the people that disagree with you are very well-intentioned. They look at poverty, and they hurt. When I drive by Memorial Hospital, I've said this to people, if God came down and said, I'm going to give you a choice of $1 billion or a magic wand, and with that magic wand, you can drive by any hospital and send everybody home healthy and intact. Guess what I want? And you think about Jonas Salk. I mean, I'm getting a little teary-eyed here. Forgive me. But I think about Jonas Salk, who developed the Salk vaccine. Now, you want to hear about a hero? They told Jonas Salk, because children were in iron lungs and they were dying and they were paralyzed from polio. And Jonas Salk came up with the vaccine. And the pharmaceutical companies, no shock here, said if you patent it, you could become, I think, a billionaire. Back then, you could be the wealthiest man on the entire planet. You know what Jonas Salk said? The vaccine belongs to the world. He wouldn't patent it. He made nothing from it. Who do you value? What do you think of that, James?
Exactly. And what do we value in the larger question? So you know, we talked about it earlier. That ideal right there, the idealism.
If he took the billion? If he took the billion, wow, he's got a billion, the wealthiest man in the world. Or the man who didn't take a penny and even vaccinated himself to prove it was safe, took all the risks and got none of the rewards. You tell me what made him great. Would he have been greater with the billion or would it have diminished him? And I would argue it would have made him trash if he had taken the billion. He said, because families won't be able to afford the vaccine and their children will die because they don't have money. He said, I could never tolerate that. This vaccine belongs to the world. That's greatness. That puts that guy, as far as I'm concerned, on the top of that pyramid. What do you think of that statement?
It was his humanity. I mean, you know, I mean, yes. It would have been the same thing as literally selling his soul to what the pharmaceutical companies would have wanted him to do. But no, he went through all that. He saved a large measure of the world, and he did it, and his humanity remained intact.
Yes, and his integrity as a human being.
Yes.
And why aren't we teaching that in the schools? Why isn't that a lesson to be taught in every school? And why aren't we teaching children in schools the responsibility that goes with parenthood? We have so many kids being born out of wedlock. There's people that run around bragging about how many women had how many children from them. Are they taking care of those kids? Of course not. A child that comes from a broken home is far less likely to succeed than a child that comes from an intact family. Why isn't that being taught in schools? Why isn't responsibility being taught in schools and values? See, we talk about what we value. Well, what we should be valuing are the values themselves. And so what I really hope everybody will take away from our show tonight, your show, I'm just a guest here, is talk to your neighbors without this nastiness of, are you stupid? No, just a moment here. I know you feel bad for people around the world, and I do too. And if I could get that magic wand, I want it. But for now, the best we can do is make America as strong as possible, because waiting in the wings are tyrannical nations, countries like China that run concentration camps, that trample human rights, countries like Iran and Russia. If ever America needed to be strong, this is the time. You know, when you're on an airplane, they tell you that if the oxygen masks come down, put yours on first so you can help the other people around you. The idiots that are out there trying to damage this country, and they're doing a hell of a job, are trying to deprive America of the oxygen mask. And you have to wonder how many politicians like Joe Biden and Eric Swalwell, as I've come to call Mr. Swalwell, are being extorted by China or America's adversaries. I don't know how you could still be a member of the United States Congress when you've been cavorting with Chinese hookers and spies. This is the only era where I could imagine such an abomination playing out. Trump was impeached for phone calls, and Joe Biden is violating the Constitution by running the biggest human trafficking operation in the history of the United States, which is so detrimental to the future and safety of America and Americans, I don't know where to begin. So this Build Back Better nonsense, why is it the media won't talk about the immigration element, and all we keep hearing about it are the taxes and the roads and all the other crap, when the biggest issue, and I think that's why they did it this way, is the amnesty, and the rest of the stuff is just a distraction. What I'm really waiting to hear is, well, we're going to change the taxes, and we'll change this, and we'll change that, and nobody will say it, but the immigration bill will still be part of it. I want everybody to call their senators and tell them this immigration bill could result in a human tsunami of tens of millions of immigrants being lawfully admitted into the United States, overwhelming the ecology and the economy of our country and destroying the United States, leaving us vulnerable and leaving the world vulnerable three tyrannical countries and some truly evil terrorist organizations and drug smuggling operations, which, by the way, are all together. China has been laundering the cartel's drug money. Hezbollah is working with the human traffickers and the drug smugglers to flood America with narcotics, so they're getting money to run terrorist operations, and they're also embedding sleeper agents in the United States. And meanwhile, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, who has the biggest no-show job in the history of the United States, she reminds me of a mob employee with a no-show job, right? I mean, this is remarkable. This is remarkable. you might have, in the days past, wondered about the sanity of our leaders or whatever. I really wonder about the loyalties. And the fact that we now have non-citizens supposedly able to vote, there is an abhorrence by our leaders for American citizens. Aliens could commit all kinds of crimes without fear, but Americans are going to become the target of the Internal Revenue Service. Think about that. This is such a disloyalty to Americans because these politicians don't know what the loyalty, what the word loyalty means. The arguments are so simple, and they're so effective, and they're so irrefutable. Just please have those conversations. Use my articles at Front Page or U.S. Inc. Go to my website, michaelcutler.net, or go to the Michael Cutler Hour Blog Talk Radio. Just click on the links to my programs. Ask your friends that disagree to read the articles. Say to them, look, if you think I'm wrong, that's cool. This guy wrote this article. I'd love to understand how you see it. And ask them a question. Always end with a question. Would you get on an airplane if you saw people sneaking past TSA getting onto your plane? If you wouldn't, why are we being forced to live among millions of people who've been able to evade a very similar vetting process we conduct at ports of entry? Talk to them about the true numbers. Talk to them about the impact this would have on the environment, on the economy, on jobs, on the future of their children. These are serious questions, and I really believe that if enough Americans were educated and came to understand the issues, and if we could only sit down at the dinner table and have an adult conversation, especially with people that disagree with us, but do it from a position of respect. They have the right to disagree with you. They absolutely do. I like vanilla ice cream. Perhaps James likes chocolate. Maybe he hates all forms of ice cream. God knows. So what? That's his choice. This is my choice. We need to learn to be respectful. See, when I was a kid and we went and played ball in the schoolyard, I loved handball. It was the only sport I was really good at. I used to play for lunch money on campus. It was a rare day I bought lunch. So if you opened your big mouth and insulted people, somebody would you know, leave you with a black eye and a couple of missing teeth. So you learn to be respectful. The anonymity of the Internet has changed that dynamic, and we're not the people we should be. People should have to sit down and face each other eye to eye and have actual conversations in person, not through some media that acts as a filter or censor, but face to face. By the way, a quick point before the program is over. Do you know that the U.S. Navy has come up with a way of dealing with the potential that the GPS system could be hacked? You know what they're doing? They're going back to teaching navigation by the stars. Everything that's old is new again. True story. Popular Mechanics reporting on that today. They're going back to using astrolabes and navigating by the stars because they can't be hacked. Maybe we need to learn how to sit down, and maybe that's part of why they don't want us having these big family get-togethers, because they don't want the American people to compare notes. When we arrested a bunch of bad guys that were part of an organization, we separated them so they couldn't collaborate. And when I watch what's going on with COVID, and I watch what's going on with the masks, My gut feeling tells me that maybe the real issue is that they don't want Americans sitting down face-to-face, having dinner, and comparing notes. There's only one version of the truth, folks. And I'm counting on all of you to accept that politics is something that we all get involved with, and it doesn't even mean only running for office. Educating our fellow Americans is a big part of that process. Knowledge is power. And so I think the perfect ending is Kennedy's last quote for today. And this is John F. Kennedy. The cost of freedom is always high, but Americans have always paid it. And one path we shall never choose, and that is the path of surrender or submission. How's that for a finale for this evening? And I wish everybody a very Merry Christmas, happy, healthy, peaceful, and safe New Year.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, our friend Michael Cutler, as always, not disappointing from the minute he gets out of the gate. It doesn't matter where we go. He ties it all up and brings us back to where we started. Michael, thank you for your friendship, for your generosity with your time. It's going to be probably in the new year we're going to have you right back, because who knows what's going to be happening. And quite frankly, I just don't want you staying away from this program too long. And by the way, when you are a guest on this show, it is our show. It's not just mine. And I'm happy to make that. I'm happy to divvy that up with you anytime you want to be here.
Well, you're very kind. And, you know, ever since 9/11, I've truly been a man on a mission. You know, when I saw what I saw on 9/11, and being an agent gave me a front row seat. I spent half my career with the Drug Task Force. I've investigated and arrested terrorists. I just want to know, and this is the question we should always ask politicians, how are your policies in the best interest of America or Americans, whether it's sanctuary cities, whether it's this insanity of Build Back Better? We should be demanding answers. And by the way, if politicians refuse to meet with you, that's insubordination. When my boss said, Mike, at 0800 hours, we're having an all-hands meeting tomorrow morning, you didn't say to him, gee whiz, I thought I'd sleep in tomorrow. When the American people tell their elected representatives, we want you to come to a town hall meeting, if they refuse, vote them out of office, because they are being insubordinate. And please don't ever forget, they are working for us. And if they're not working for us, they're insubordinate. And there's a solution to insubordination. Fire them. Please remember one thing, folks, and one thing alone. Democracy is not a spectator sport. Please, I beg you, get involved. We're in deep trouble these days. But we can fix it. We've had problems in the past, and America always seems to come through. And I expect us to do no less these days. But it's going to take hard work and every American getting together and focusing on what makes us the most similar, not what makes us the most different.
An informed electorate is the only way that we're going to get effective and common sense government. And that's on all levels, from dog catcher to that. You know, I wish I was hoping, and I'm sure the Democrats were, that Disney would have had the animatronic Joe Biden perfected by now, and they wouldn't
do,
have to use
move.
The
they do, but it doesn't move.
It's a paperweight. Michael, thank you once again for being with us, and I'm looking forward to having you back just as quick as we can. Merry Christmas,
well,
my friend.
Happy New Year. Merry Christmas
all right,
to you
now.
And I'll see you next year. Okay, bye-bye.
All right. Oh, God. What a terrific guy. I mean, that's, and, you know, he's always been this way with us. From the very first time I met him and I asked him to come on the program, he's always been generous with his time. He is a well fountain, a spring of information. And 2 hours with Mike Cutler is a master's course in whatever the topics may be. I promise you that. And that's about all the time we've got. We've got about a minute left. I'm just going to go ahead and wrap up now. Thank you guys for the opportunity to spend a little time with you. We'll be here on Thursday when our guests will be, thank you, Penelope, when our guests will be Claire Lopez from Lopez Liberty, LLC, former associate with Frank Gaffney in the Center for Security Policy, a CIA analyst, and now she's branched out with Lopez Liberty. She'll be with us on Thursday. Wow, man. Another great show in the books. Thank you once again to our friend, my friend, and a guy I'm proud to call friend, Michael Cutler. You guys take good care of yourselves. We'll be back on Thursday taking a look at things as we do through a conservative's perspective. In the meantime, God bless you. God bless America. And we'll see you on Thursday, 7 p.m. Claire Lopez is our guest.